great false wisdom taught slaves and pragmatists alike that white is right. I can tell you his destiny. He'll do your bidding, and for that his blindness is his chief asset. He's your man, friend, your man and your destiny. Now the two of you, descend the stairs into chaos and get the hell out of here. I'm sick of both of you pitiful obscenities. Get out before I do you both the favor of bashing your heads. I saw his motion toward the big white pitcher on the washstand and stepped between him and Mr. Norton, guiding Mr. Norton swiftly through the doorway. Looking back, I saw him leaning against the wall, making a sound that was a blending of laughter and tears. "Hurry. The man is as insane as the rest," Mr. Norton said. "Yes, sir," I said, noticing a new note in his voice. The balcony was now as noisy as the floor below. The girls and drunken vets were stumbling about with drinks in their hands. Just as we went past an open door, Edna saw us and grabbed my arm. "Where you taking white folks?" she demanded. "Back to school," I said, shaking her off.
"You don't want to go up there, white folks, baby," she said. I tried to push past her. "I ain't lying," she said. "I'm the best little homemaker in the business."
Okay, but please, let us alone," I pleaded. You'll get me into trouble." We were going down the stairs into the milling men now, and she started to scream.
"Pay me, then. If he's too good for me, let him pay."
And before I could stop her, she had pushed Mr. Norton, and both of us were stumbling swiftly down the stairs. I landed against a man who looked up with the anonymous familiarity of a drunk and shoved me hard away. I saw Mr. Norton spin past as I sank farther into the crowd. Somewhere I could hear the girl screaming and Hallie's voice yelling,
"Hey, hey, hey now!"
Then I was aware of fresh air and saw that I was near the door and pushed my way free and stood panting and preparing to plunge back for Mr. Norton when I heard Hallie calling,
"Make way, y'all!"
and saw him piloting Mr. Norton to the door.
"Woo!"
he said, releasing the white man and shaking his huge head. "Thanks, Hallie," I said, and got no further. I saw Mr. Norton, his face pale again, his white suit rumpled, topple and fall, his head scraping against the screen of the door.
"Hey!"
I opened the door and raised him up.
"God damn it! Out again," Hallie said. "How come you bring this white man here, schoolboy?"
Is he dead?
"Dead," he said, stepping back indignantly. "He can't die."
What'll I do, Hallie?
"Not in my place. He can't die,"
he said, kneeling. Mr. Norton looked up. "No one is dead or dying," he said acidly. "Remove your hands." Hallie fell away, surprised.
"I sure am glad. You show you all right. I thought sure you was dead this time."
"For God's sake, be quiet," I exploded nervously. "You should be glad that he's all right." Mr. Norton was visibly angry now, a raw place showing on his forehead. I hurried ahead of him to the car. He climbed in unaided, and I got under the wheel, smelling the heated odor of mints and cigar smoke. He was silent as I drove away. The wheel felt like an alien thing in my hands as I followed the white line of the highway. Heat rays from the late afternoon sun arose from the gray concrete, shimmering like the weary tones of a distant bugle blown upon still midnight air. In the mirror I could see Mr. Norton staring out vacantly upon the empty fields, his mouth stern, his white forehead livid where it had scraped the screen. And seeing him, I felt the fear balled coldly within me unfold. What would happen now? What would the school officials say? In my mind, I visualized Dr. Bledsoe's face when he saw Mr. Norton. I thought of the glee certain folks at home would feel if I were expelled. Tatlock's grinning face danced through my mind. What would the white folks think who'd sent me to college? Was Mr. Norton angry at me? In the golden day, he had seemed more curious than anything else, until the vet had started talking wild. Damn True Blood. It was his fault. If we hadn't sat in the sun so long, Mr. Norton would not have needed whiskey, and I wouldn't have gone to the golden day. Why would the vets act that way with a white man in the house? I headed the car through the red brick campus gateposts with a sense of cold apprehension. Now even the rows of neat dormitories seemed to threaten me, the rolling lawns appearing as hostile as the gray highway with its white dividing line. As of its own compulsion, the car slowed as we passed the chapel with its low, sweeping eaves. The sun shone coolly through the avenue of trees, dappling the curving drive. Students strolled through the shade down a hill of tender grass toward the brick-red stretch of tennis courts. Far beyond, players in whites showed sharp against the red of the courts surrounded by grass, a gay vista washed by the sun. In the brief interval, I heard a cheer arise. My predicament struck me like a stab. I had a sense of losing control of the car and slammed on the brakes in the middle of the road, then apologized and drove on. Here, within this quiet greenness, I possessed the only identity I had ever known, and I was losing it. In this brief moment of passage, I became aware of the connection between these lawns and buildings and my hopes and dreams. I wanted to stop the car and talk with Mr. Norton, to beg his pardon for what he had seen, to plead and show him tears, unashamed tears like those of a child before his parent, to denounce all we'd seen and heard, to assure him that far from being like any of the people we had seen, I hated them, that I believed in the principles of the Founder with all my heart and soul, and that I believed in his goodness, and that I believed in his own goodness and kindness in extending the hand of his benevolence to helping us poor, ignorant people out of the mire and darkness. I would do his bidding and teach others to rise up as he has wished them to, teach them to be thrifty, decent, upright citizens, contributing to the welfare of all, shunning all but the straight and narrow path that he and the Founder had stretched before us. If only he were not angry with me, if only he would give me another chance. Tears filled my eyes, and the walks and buildings flowed and froze for a moment in mist, glittering as in winter when rain froze on the grass and foliage and turned the campus into a world of whiteness, waiting and bending both trees and bushes with fruit of crystal. Then, in the twinkling of my eyes, it was gone, and the here and now of heat and greatness returned. If only I could make Mr. Norton understand what the school meant to me. "Shall I stop at your room, sir?" I asked, "or shall I take you to the administration building? Dr. Bledsoe might be worried."
"To my rooms, then bring Dr. Bledsoe to me," he answered tersely.
"Yes, sir." In the mirror I saw him dabbing gingerly at his forehead with a crinkled handkerchief.
"You'd better send the school physician to me also," he said.
I stopped the car in front of a small building with white pillars like those of an old plantation manor house, got out and opened the door. "Mr. Norton, please, sir, I'm sorry, I—" He looked at me sternly, his eyes narrowed, saying nothing.
I didn't know. Please.
"Send Dr. Bledsoe to me,"
he said, turning away and swinging up the graveled path to the building. I got back into the car and drove slowly to the administration building. A girl waved gaily as I passed, a bunch of violets in her hand. Two teachers in dark suits talked decorously beside a broken fountain. The building was quiet. Going upstairs, I visualized Dr. Bledsoe, with his broad, globular face that seemed to take its form from the fat pressing from the inside, which, as air pressing against the membrane of a balloon, gave it shape and buoyancy. Old Buckethead, some of the fellows called him. I never had. He had been kind to me from the first, perhaps because of the letters which the school superintendent had sent to him when I arrived. But more than that, he was the example of everything I hoped to be. Influential with wealthy men all over the country, consulted in matters concerning the race, a leader of his people, the possessor of not one, but two Cadillacs, a good salary and a soft, good-looking and creamy-complexioned wife. What was more, while black and bald and everything white folks poked fun at, he had achieved power and authority, had, while black and wrinkle-headed, made himself of more importance in the world than most southern white men. They could laugh at him, but they couldn't ignore him. "He's been looking all over for you," the girl at the desk said. When I walked in, he looked up from the telephone and said, "Never mind. He's here now," and hung up. "Where's Mr. Norton?" he demanded excitedly. "Is he all right?"
Yes, sir. I left him at his rooms and came to drive you down. He wishes to see you.
"Is anything wrong?" he said, getting up hurriedly and coming around the desk. I hesitated. "Well, is there?"
The panicky beating of my heart seemed to blur my vision.
"Not now, sir."
"Now? What do you mean?"
"Well, sir, he had some kind of fainting spell."
"Oh, my God. I knew something was wrong. Why didn't you get in touch with me?"
He grabbed his black Homburg, starting for the door.
"Come on."
I followed him, trying to explain.
He's all over it now, sir, and we were too far away for me to phone." "Why did you take him so far?" he said, moving with great bustling energy.
I drove him where he wanted to go, sir."
"Where was that?"
"Back of the slave quarter section," I said with dread.
"The quarters? Boy, are you a fool? Didn't you know better than to take a trustee out there?"
He asked me to, sir." We were going down the walk now, through the spring air, and he stopped to look at me with exasperation, as though I'd suddenly told him black was white.
"Damn what he wants," he said, climbing in the front seat beside me. "Haven't you the sense God gave a dog? We take these white folks where we want them to go. We show them what we want them to see. Don't you know that? I thought you had some sense."
Reaching Rab Hall, I stopped the car, weak with bewilderment.
"Don't sit there," he said. "Come with me."
Just inside the building, I got another shock. As we approached a mirror, Dr. Bledsoe stopped and composed his angry face like a sculptor, making it a bland mask, leaving only the sparkle of his eyes to betray the emotion that I had seen only a moment before. He looked steadily at himself for a moment. Then we moved quietly down the silent hall and up the stairs. A co-ed sat at a graceful table stacked with magazines. Before a great window stood a large aquarium containing colored stones and a small replica of a feudal castle surrounded by goldfish that seemed to remain motionless despite the fluttering of their lacy fins, a momentary, motionful suspension of time.
"Is Mr. Norton in his room?" he said to the girl.
"Yes, sir, Dr. Bledsoe, sir," she said. "He said to tell you to come in when you got here." Pausing at the door, I heard him clear his throat, then rap softly upon the panel with his fist.
"Mr. Norton?" he said, his lips already a smile. And at the answer, I followed him inside.
It was a large, light room. Mr. Norton sat in a huge wing chair with his jacket off. A change of clothing lay on the cool bedspread. Above a spacious fireplace, an oil portrait of the founder looked down at me, remotely, benign, sad, and in that hot instant, profoundly disillusioned. Then a veil seemed to fall.
"I've been worried about you, sir," Dr. Bledsoe said. "We expected you at the afternoon session."
Now it's beginning, I thought. Now. And suddenly he rushed forward.
"Mr. Norton, your head," he cried.
A strange grandmotherly concern in his voice.
"What happened, sir?"
"It's nothing." Mr. Norton's face was immobile. "A mere scratch." Dr. Bledsoe whirled around, his face outraged.
"Get the doctor over here," he said. "Why didn't you tell me that Mr. Norton had been injured?"
I've already taken care of that, sir," I said softly, seeing him whirl back.
Mr. Norton, I'm so sorry," he crooned. "I thought I had sent you a boy who was careful, a sensible young man. Why, we've never had an accident before. Never, not in 75 years. I assure you, sir, that he shall be disciplined, severely disciplined."
"But there was no automobile accident," Mr. Norton said kindly, "nor was the boy responsible. You may send him away. We won't need him now." My eyes suddenly filled. I felt a wave of gratitude at his words.
"Don't be kind, sir," Dr. Bledsoe said. "You can't be soft with these people. We mustn't pamper them. An accident to a guest of this college while he is in the charge of a student is without question the student's fault. That's one of our strictest rules." Then to me, "Return to your dormitory and remain there until further notice."
"But it was out of my control, sir," I said, "just as Mr. Norton said."
"I'll explain, young man," Mr. Norton said with a half-smile. "Everything will be explained."
"Thank you, sir," I said, seeing Dr. Bledsoe looking at me with no change of expression.
"On second thought," he said, "I want you to be in chapel this evening. Understand me, sir?"
"Yes, sir." I opened the door with a cold hand, bumping into the girl who had been at the table when we went inside.
I'm sorry, she said.
"Look like you have old bucket-head kind of mad."
I said nothing as she walked beside me expectantly. A red sun cast its light upon the campus as I started for my dormitory.
"Will you take a message to my boyfriend for me?" she said.
"Who is he?" I said, trying hard to conceal my tension and fear.
"Jack Maston," she said.
"Okay. He's in the room next to mine."
"That's swell," she said with a big smile. "The dean put me on duty, so I missed him this afternoon. Just tell him that I said the grass is green."
"What?"
"The grass is green. It's our secret code. He'll understand."
"The grass is green," I said.
"That's it." "Thank you, lover," she said.
I felt like cursing as I watched her hurrying back into the building, hearing her flat-heeled shoes crunching the graveled walk. Here she was playing with some silly secret code at the very minute my fate for the rest of my life was being decided. The grass was green, and they'd meet, and she'd be sent home pregnant. But even so, in less disgrace than I. If I only knew what they were saying about me. Suddenly I had an idea, and ran after her into the building and up the stairs. In the hall, fine dust played in a shaft of sunlight, stirred by her hurried passing. But she had disappeared. I had thought to ask her to listen at the door and tell me what was said. I gave it up. If she were discovered, I'd have that on my conscience, too. Besides, I was ashamed for anyone to know about my predicament. It was too stupid to be believed. Down the long length of the wide hall, I heard someone unseen skipping down the stairs, singing. A girl's sweet, hopeful voice. I left quietly and hurried to my dorm. I lay in my room with my eyes closed, trying to think. The tension gripped my insides. Then I heard someone coming up the hall and stiffened. Had they sent for me already? Nearby, a door opened and closed, leaving me as tense as ever. To whom could I turn for help? I could think of no one. No one to whom I could even explain what had happened at the Golden Day. Everything was upset inside me, and Dr. Bledsoe's attitude towards Mr. Norton was the most confusing of all. I dared not repeat what he'd said, for fear that it would lessen my chances of remaining in school. It just wasn't true. I had misunderstood. He couldn't have said what I thought he had said. Hadn't I seen him approach white visitors too often with his hat in his hand, bowing humbly and respectfully? Hadn't he refused to eat in the dining hall with white guests of the school entering only after they had finished and then refusing to sit down but remaining standing, his hat in his hand, while he addressed them eloquently, then leaving with a humble bow? Hadn't he? Hadn't he? I had seen him too often as I peeped through the door between the dining room and the kitchen. I, myself. And wasn't his favorite spiritual, "Live a Humble"? And in the chapel on Sunday evenings upon the platform, hadn't he always taught us to live content in our place in 1,000 unambiguous words? He had. And I had believed him. I had believed without question his illustrations of the good which came of following the Founder's path. It was my affirmation of life, and they couldn't send me away for something I didn't do. They simply couldn't. But that vet, he was so crazy that he corrupted sane men. He had tried to turn the world inside out. God damn him! He had made Mr. Norton angry. He had no right to talk to a white man as he had, not with me, to take the punishment. Someone shook me and I recoiled, my legs moist and trembling. It was my roommate.
"What the hell, roomie?" he said. "Let's go to chow."
I looked at his confident mug. He was going to be a farmer. "I don't have an appetite," I said with a sigh.
"Okay now," he said. "You can try to kid me, but don't say I didn't wake you."
"No," I said.
"Who you expecting, a broad-butt gal with ball-bearing hips?"
"No," I said.
"You better stop that, roomie," he grinned. "It'll ruin your health, make you a moron. You ought to take you a gal and show her how the moon rises over all that green grass on the Founder's grave. Man, go to hell," I said.
He left laughing, opening the door to the sound of many footsteps from the hall, supper time. The sound of departing voices. Something of my life seemed to retreat with them into a gray distance, moiling. Then a knock sounded at the door, and I sprang up, my heart tense. A small student wearing a freshman's cap stuck his head in the door, shouting,
"Dr. Bledsoe said he wants to see you down at Rab Hall."
And then he was gone before I could question him, his footsteps thundering down the hall as he raced to dinner before the last bell sounded. At Mr. Norton's door, I stopped, with my hand on the knob, mumbling a prayer. "Come in, young man," he said to my knock. He was dressed in fresh linen, the light falling upon his white hair as upon silk floss. A small piece of gauze was plastered to his forehead. He was alone.
"I'm sorry, sir," I apologized, "but I was told that Dr. Bledsoe wanted to see me here."
"That's correct," he said, "but Dr. Bledsoe had to leave. You'll find him in his office after chapel."
"Thank you, sir," I said and turned to go. He cleared his throat behind me.
"Young man,"
I turned hopefully.
"Young man, I have explained to Dr. Bledsoe that you were not at fault. I believe he understands." I was so relieved that at first I could only look at him, a small, silken-haired, white-suited Saint Nicholas, seeing through misty eyes.
"I certainly do thank you, sir," I managed finally.
He studied me silently, his eyes slightly narrowed.
"Will you need me this evening, sir?" I asked.
"No, I won't be needing the machine. Business is taking me away sooner than I expected. I leave late tonight."
"I could drive to the station, sir," I said hopefully.
"Thank you, but Dr. Bledsoe has already arranged it."
"Oh,"
I said with disappointment. I had hoped that by serving him the rest of the week, I could win back his esteem. Now, I would not have the opportunity.
"Well, I hope you have a pleasant trip, sir," I said.
"Thank you," he said, suddenly smiling.
"And maybe the next time you come, I'll be able to answer some of the questions you asked me this afternoon."
"Questions?" His eyes narrowed.
"Yes, sir, about your fate," I said.
"Ah, yes. Yes," he said.
"And I intend to read Emerson, too."
"Very good. Self-reliance is a most worthy virtue. I shall look forward with the greatest of interest to learning your contribution to my fate." He motioned me toward the door. "And don't forget to see Dr. Bledsoe." I left somewhat reassured, but not completely. I still had to face Dr. Bledsoe, and I had to attend chapel. At the sound of vespers, I moved across the campus with groups of students walking slowly, their voices soft in the mellow dusk. I remember the yellowed globes of frosted glass making lacy silhouettes on the gravel and the walk of leaves and branches above us as we moved slow through the dusk, so restless with scents of lilac, honeysuckle, and verbena, and the feel of spring greenness, and I recall the sudden arpeggios of laughter lilting across the tender springtime grass. Gay-welling, far-floating, fluent, spontaneous, a bell-like feminine fluting, then suppressed, as though snuffed swiftly and irrevocably beneath the quiet solemnity of the vesperate air, now vibrant with somber chapel bells. Dong, dong, dong. Above the decorous walking around me, sounds of footsteps leaving the verandas of far-flung buildings and moving toward the walks and over the walks to the asphalt drives lined with whitewashed stones, those cryptic messages for men and women, boys and girls, heading quietly toward where the visitors waited. And we, moving not in the mood of worship, but of judgment, as though even here in the filtering dusk, here beneath the deep indigo sky, here alive with looping swifts and darting moths, here in the here-ness of the night not yet lighted by the moon that looms blood-red behind the chapel like a fallen sun, its radiance shedding not upon the here-dusk of twittering bats nor on the there-night of cricket and whippoorwill, but focused short-rayed upon our place of convergence. And we, drifting forward with rigid motions, limbs stiff and voices now silent, as though on exhibit, even in the dark and the moon, a white man's bloodshot eye. And I move more rigid than all the others with a sense of judgment. The vibrations of the chapel bells stirring the depths of my turmoil, moving towards its nexus with a sense of doom. And I remember the chapel with its sweeping eaves long and low as though risen bloody from the earth like the rising moon, vine-covered and earth-colored, as though more earth-sprung than man-sprung. And my mind rushing for relief away from the spring dusk and flower scents, away from the time scene of the crucifixion to the time mood of the birth, from spring dusk and vespers to the high, clear, lucid moon of winter and snow, glinting upon the dwarfed pines where instead of the bells, the organ and the trombone choir speak carols to the distances drifted with snow, making of the night air a sea of crystal water lapping the slumbering land to the farthest reaches of sound for endless miles, bringing the new dispensation even to the golden day, even unto the house of madness. But in the here-ness of dusk, I am moving toward the doom-like bells through the flowered air beneath the rising moon. Into the doors, and into the soft lights I go, silently, past the rows of puritanical benches, straight and torturous, finding that to which I am assigned, and bending my body to its agony. There at the head of the platform, with its pulpit and rail of polished brass, are the banked and pyramided heads of the student choir, faces composed and stolid above uniforms of black and white, and above them, stretching to the ceiling, the organ pipes looming, a Gothic hierarchy of dull, gilded gold. Around me, the students move with faces frozen in solemn masks, and I seem to hear already the voices mechanically raised in the songs the visitors loved. Loved, demanded, sung, an ultimatum accepted and ritualized, an allegiance recited for the peace it imparted, and for that, perhaps, loved. Loved as the defeated come to love the symbols of their conquerors, a gesture of acceptance, of terms laid down and reluctantly approved. And here, sitting rigid, I remember the evening spent before the sweeping platform in awe and in pleasure, and in the pleasure of awe. Remember the short formal sermons intoned from the pulpit there, rendered in smooth, articulate tones with calm assurance, purged of the wild emotions of the crude preachers most of us knew in our hometowns and of whom we were deeply ashamed. These logical appeals, which reached us more like the thrust of a firm and formal design, requiring nothing more than the lucidity of uncluttered periods, the lulling movement of multisyllabic words to thrill and console us. And I remember, too, the talks of visiting speakers, all eager to inform us of how fortunate we were to be part of the vast and formal ritual, how fortunate to belong to this family sheltered from those lost in ignorance and darkness. Here, upon this stage, the black rite of Horatio Alger was performed to God's own acting script, with millionaires come down to portray themselves, not merely acting out the myth of their goodness and wealth and success and power and benevolence and authority in cardboard masks, but themselves, these virtues concretely. Not the wafer and the wine, but the flesh and the blood, vibrant and alive, and vibrant even when stooped, ancient and withered, and who, in face of this, would not believe, could even doubt. And I remember, too, how we confronted those others, those who had set me here in this Eden, whom we knew, though we didn't know, who were unfamiliar in their familiarity, who trailed their words to us through blood and violence and ridicule and condescension, with drawling smiles, who extorted and threatened, intimidated with innocent words as they described to us the limitations of our lives and the vast boldness of our aspirations, the staggering folly of our impatience to rise even higher, who, as they talked, aroused furtive visions within me, of blood froth sparkling their chins like their familiar tobacco juice, and upon their lips the curdled milk of a million black slave mammies' withered dugs, a treacherous and fluid knowledge of our being, imbibed at our source and now regurgitated foul upon us. This was our world, they said as they described it to us, this our horizon and its earth, its seasons and its climate, its spring and its summer and its fall and harvest some unknown millennium ahead, and these its floods and cyclones, and they themselves our thunder and lightning. And this we must accept and love, and accept even if we do not love. We must accept. Even when those were absent, and the men who made the railroads and ships and towers of stone were before our eyes, in the flesh, their voices different, unweighted with recognizable danger, and their delight in our songs more sincere seeming, their regard for our welfare marked by an almost benign and impersonal indifference. But the words of the others were stronger than the strength of philanthropic dollars, deeper than shafts sunk in the earth for oil and gold, more awe-inspiring than the miracles fabricated in scientific laboratories. For their most innocent words were acts of violence to which we of the campus were hypersensitive, though we endured them not. And there, on the platform, I, too, had stridden and debated, a student leader directing my voice at the highest beams and farthest rafters, ringing them, the accents staccato upon the ridgepole and echoing back with a tinkling like words hurled to the trees of a wilderness or into a well of slate-gray water, more sound than sense, a play upon the resonances of buildings, an assault upon the temples of the ear. Ha! To the gray-haired matron in the final row. Ha! Miss Susie Gresham, back there looking at the co-ed, smiling at the he-ed. Listen to me, the bungling bugler of words, imitating the trumpet and the trombone's timbre, playing thematic variations like a baritone horn. Hey, old connoisseur of voice sounds, of voices without messages, of newsless winds, listen to the vowel sounds and the crackling dentals, to the low, harsh gutturals of empty anguish, now riding the curve of a preacher's rhythm I heard long ago in a Baptist church, stripped now of its imagery, no suns having hemorrhages, no moons weeping tears, no earthworms refusing the sacred flesh and dancing in the earth on Easter morn, ha, singing achievement, ha, booming success, intoning, ha, accept.
acceptance. Ha! A river of word sounds filled with drowned passions floating. Ha! With wrecks of unachievable ambitions and stillborn revolts sweeping their ears. Ha! Ranged stiff before me, necks stretched forward with listening ears. Ha! A spraying the ceiling and a drumming the dark-stained after-rafter. That seasoned cross-arm of torturous timber mellowed in the kiln of a thousand voices playing. Ha! As upon a xylophone, words marching like the student band up the campus and down again, blaring triumphant sounds empty of triumphs. Hey, Miss Susie, the sound of words that were no words, counterfeit notes singing achievements yet unachieved, riding upon the wings of my voice out to you, old matron who knew the voice sounds of the founder and knew the accents and echo of his promise, your gray old head cocked with the young around you, your eyes closed, face ecstatic as I toss the word sounds in my breath, my bellows, my fountain, like bright colored balls in a water spout. Hear me, old matron, justify now this sound with your dear old nod of affirmation, your closed eye, smile, and bow of recognition, who'll never be fooled with the mere content of words, not my words, not these pin-feathered flighters that stroke your lids till they flutter with the ecstasy, with but the mere echoed noise of the promise. And after the singing and outward marching, you seize my hand and sing out quavering, boy, someday you'll make the founder proud. Ha! Susie Gresham, Mother Gresham, guardian of that hot young woman on the Puritan benches who couldn't see your Jordan's water for their private steam. You relic of slavery, whom the campus loved but did not understand. Aged of slavery, yet bearer of something warm and vital and all-enduring, of which in that island of shame we were not ashamed. It was to you on the final row I directed my rush of sound, and it was you of whom I thought with shame and regret as I waited for the ceremony to begin.
The honored guests moved silently upon the platform, herded toward their high, carved chairs by Dr. Bledsoe, with the decorum of a portly head waiter. Like some of the guests, he wore striped trousers and a swallow-tail coat with black braided lapels topped by a rich ascot tie. It was his regular dress for such occasions, yet for all its elegance, he managed to make himself look humble. Somehow, his trousers inevitably bagged at the knees and the coat slouched in the shoulders. I watched him smiling at first one and then another of the guests, of whom all but one were white. And as I saw him placing his hand upon their arms, touching their backs, whispering to a tall, angular-faced trustee who in turn touched his arm familiarly, I felt a shudder. I too had touched a white man today, and I felt that it had been disastrous. And I realized then that he was the only one of us whom I knew, except perhaps a barber or a nursemaid, who could touch a white man with impunity. And I remembered, too, that whenever white guests came upon the platform, he placed his hand upon them as though exercising a powerful magic. I watched his teeth flash as he took a white hand. Then, with all seated, he went to his place at the end of the row of chairs. Several terraces of students' faces above them, the organist, his eyes glinting at the console, was waiting with his head turned over his shoulder, and I saw Dr. Bledsoe, his eyes roaming over the audience, suddenly nod, without turning his head. It was as though he had given a downbeat with an invisible baton. The organist turned and hunched his shoulders. A high cascade of sound bubbled from the organ, spreading thick and clinging over the chapel, slowly surging. The organist twisted and turned on his bench, with his feet flying beneath him as though dancing to rhythms totally unrelated to the decorous thunder of his organ. And Dr. Bledsoe sat with a benign smile of inward concentration. Yet his eyes were darting swiftly, first over the rows of students, then over the section reserved for teachers, his swift glance carrying a threat for all.
for he demanded that everyone attend these sessions. It was here that policy was announced in broadest rhetoric. I seemed to feel his eyes resting upon my face as he swept the section in which I sat. I looked at the guests on the platform. They sat with that alert relaxation with which they always met our upturned eyes. I wondered to which of them I might go to intercede for me with Dr. Bledsoe, but within myself I knew that there was no one. In spite of the array of important men beside him, and despite the posture of humility and meekness which made him seem smaller than the others, although he was physically larger, Dr. Bledsoe made his presence felt by us with a far greater impact. I remembered the legend of how he had come to the college, a barefoot boy who in his fervor for education had trudged with his bundle of ragged clothing across two states, and how he was given a job feeding slop to the hogs, but had made himself the best slop dispenser in the history of the school, and how the founder had been impressed and made him his office boy. Each of us knew of his rise over years of hard work to the presidency, and each of us at some time wished that he had walked to the school or pushed a wheelbarrow or performed some other act of determination and sacrifice to attest his eagerness for knowledge. I remembered the admiration and fear he inspired in everyone on the campus. The pictures in the Negro press captioned "Educator" in type that exploded like a rifle shot, his face looking out at you with utmost confidence. To us, he was more than just a president of a college. He was a leader, a statesman who carried our problems to those above us, even unto the White House. And in days past, he had conducted the president himself about the campus. He was our leader and our magic, who kept the endowment high, the funds for scholarships plentiful, and publicity moving through the channels of the press. He was our cold black daddy, of whom we were afraid. As the organ voices died, I saw a thin brown girl arise noiselessly with the rigid control of a modern dancer high in the upper rows of the choir and begin to sing a cappella. She began softly, as though singing to herself of emotions of utmost privacy, a sound not addressed to the gathering, but which they overheard almost against her will. Gradually she increased its volume until at times the voice seemed to become a disembodied force that sought to enter her, to violate her, shaking her, rocking her rhythmically, as though it had become the source of her being rather than the fluid web of her own creation. I saw the guests on the platform turn to look behind them to see the thin brown girl in white choir robe standing high against the organ pipes, herself become before our eyes a pipe of contained, controlled, and sublimated anguish, a thin, plain face transformed by music. I could not understand the words, but only the mood, sorrowful, vague, and ethereal of the singing. It throbbed with nostalgia, regret, and repentance. And I sat with a lump in my throat as she sank slowly down, not a sitting, but a controlled collapsing, as though she were balancing, sustaining the simmering bubble of her final tone by some delicate rhythm of her heart's blood, or by some mystic concentration of her being, focused upon the sound through the contained liquid of her large, uplifted eyes. There was no applause, only the appreciation of a profound silence. The white guests exchanged smiles of approval. I sat thinking of the dread possibility of having to leave all this, of being expelled, imagining the return home and the rebukes of my parents. I looked out at the scene now from far back in my despair, seeing the platform and its actors as though a reversed telescope. Small, doll-like figures moving through some meaningless ritual. Someone up there, above the alternating moss-dry and grease-slick heads of the students, rode before me, was making announcements from a lectern on which a dim light shone. Another figure rose and led a prayer. Someone spoke. Then around me, everyone was singing, lead me to a rock that is higher than I. And as though the sound contained some force more impervious than the image of the scene of which it was the living connective tissue, I was pulled back to its immediacy. One of the guests had risen to speak. A man of striking ugliness. Fat, with a bullet head set on a short neck with a nose much too wide for its face, upon which he wore black-lensed glasses. He had been seated next to Dr. Bledsoe, but so concerned had I been with the president that I hadn't really seen him. My eyes had focused only upon the white man and Dr. Bledsoe, so that now, as he rose and crossed slowly to the center of the platform, I had the notion that part of Dr. Bledsoe had arisen and moved forward, leaving his other part smiling in the chair. He stood before us, relaxed, his white collar gleaming like a band between his black face and his dark garments, dividing his head from his body, his short arms crossed before his barrel like a black little Buddha's. For a moment, he stood with his large head lifted as though thinking. Then he began speaking, his voice round and vibrant, as he told us of his pleasure in being allowed to visit the school once more after many years. Having been preaching in a northern city, he had seen it last in the final days of the founder when Dr. Bledsoe was the second in command. "Those were wonderful days," he droned. "Significant days. Days filled with great portent." As he talked, he made a cage of his hands by touching his fingertips. Then with his small feet pressing together, he began a slow, rhythmic rocking, tilting forward on his toes until it seemed he would fall, then back on his heels, the lights catching his black-lensed glasses until it seemed that his head floated free of his body and was held close to it only by the white band of his collar. And as he tilted, he talked until a rhythm was established. Then he was renewing the dream in our hearts. "This barren land after emancipation," he intoned. "This land of darkness and sorrow, of ignorance and degradation, where the hand of brother had been turned against brother, father against son, and son against father, where master had turned against slave and slave against master, where all was strife and darkness and aching land. And into this land came a humble prophet, lowly like the humble carpenter of Nazareth, a slave and a son of slaves, knowing only his mother. A slave born, but marked from the beginning by a high intelligence and princely personality. Born in the lowest part of this barren, war-scarred land, yet somehow shedding light upon it where'er he passed through. I'm sure you have heard of his precarious infancy, his precious life almost destroyed by an insane cousin who splashed the babe with lye and shriveled his seed, and how, a mere babe, he lay 9 days in a death-like coma and then suddenly and miraculously recovered. You might say that it was as though he had risen from the dead or been reborn. Oh, my young friends," he cried, beaming, "my young friends, it is indeed a beautiful story. I'm sure you've heard it many times. Recall how he came upon his initial learning through shrewd questioning of his little masters, the elder masters never suspecting, and how he learned his alphabet and taught himself to read and solve the secret of words, going instinctively to the Holy Bible with its great wisdom for his first knowledge. And you know how he escaped and made his way across mountain and valley to that place of learning, and how he persisted and worked noon times, nights, and mornings for the privilege of studying, or, as the old folk would say, of rubbing his head against the college wall. You know of his brilliant career, how already he was a moving orator. Then his penniless graduation and his return after years to this country. And then his great struggle beginning. Picture it, my young friends. The clouds of darkness all over the land, black folk and white folk full of fear and hate, wanting to go forward, but each fearful of the other. A whole region is caught in a terrible tension. Everyone is perplexed with the question of what must be done to dissolve this fear and hatred that crouched over the land like a demon waiting to spring. And you know how he came and showed them the way. Oh, yes, my friends, I'm sure you've heard it time and time again, of this godly man's labors, his great humility, and his undimming vision, the fruits of which you enjoy today, concrete made flesh. His dream conceived in the starkness and darkness of slavery, fulfilled now even in the air you breathe, in the sweet harmonies of your blended voices, in the knowledge which each of you, daughters and granddaughters, sons and grandsons of slaves, all of you partaking of it in bright and well-equipped classrooms. You must see this slave, this black Aristotle, moving slowly, with sweet patience, with a patience not of mere man, but of God-inspired faith. See him moving slowly as he surmounts each and every opposition, rendering unto Caesar that which was Caesar's, yes, but steadfastly seeking for you that bright horizon which you now enjoy. All this, he said, spreading his fingers palm down before him, has been told and retold throughout the land, inspiring a humble but fast-rising people. You have heard it, and it, this true story of rich implication, this living parable of proven glory and humble nobility, and it, as I say, has made you free. Even you, who have come to this shrine only this semester, know it. You have heard his name from your parents, for it was he who led them to the path, guiding them like a great captain, like that great pilot of ancient times who led his people safe and unharmed across the bottom of the blood-red sea. And your parents followed this remarkable man across the black sea of prejudice, safely out of the land of ignorance, through the storms of fear and anger, shouting, "Let my people go!" when it was necessary, whispering it during those times when whispering was wisest, and he was heard. I listened, my back pressing against the hard bench with a numbness, my emotions woven into his words as upon a loom. "And remember," he said, "when he entered a certain state at cotton-picking time, his enemies had plotted to take his life, and recall how during his journey he was stopped by the strange figure of a man whose pitted features revealed no inkling of whether he was black or white Some say he was a Greek, some a Mongolian, others a mulatto, and others still a simple white man of God. Whoever and whatsoever, and we must not rule out the possibility of an emissary direct from above. Oh, yes, and remember how he appeared suddenly, startling both founder and horse as he gave warning, telling the founder to leave the horse and buggy there in the road and proceed immediately to a certain cabin, then slipped silently away, so silently, my young friends, that the founder doubted his very existence. And you know how the great man continued, through the dusk, determined, though puzzled, as he approached the town. He was lost, lost in reverie, until the crack of the first rifle sounded, then the almost fatal volley that creased his skull, oh my, and left him stunned and apparently lifeless. I have heard him tell with his own lips how consciousness returned while they were still upon him, examining their foul deed, and how he lay biting his heart, lest they hear it and wipe out their failure with a coup de grace, as the French would say. Ha! And I'm sure you've each of you lived with him through his escape, he said, seeming to look directly into my watered eyes. You awakened when he awakened, rejoiced when he rejoiced at their leaving without further harm, arising when he arose, seeing with his eyes the prints of their milling footsteps and the cartridges dropped in the dust about the imprint of his fallen body, yes, and the cold, dust-encrusted but not quite fatal blood, and you hurried with him, full of doubt, to the cabin designated by the stranger, where he met that seemingly demented black man, you remember, that old one laughed at by the children in the town square, old, comic-faced, crafty, cotton-headed, and yet it was he who bound up your wounds with the wounds of the founder. He, the old slave, showing a surprising knowledge of such matters, germology and scabology, he called it. And what a youthful skill of the hands! For he shaved our skull and cleansed our wound, and bound it neat with bandages stolen from the home of an unsuspecting leader of the mob. Ha! And you recall how you plunged with the founder, the leader, deep into the black art of escape, guided at first, indeed initiated, by the seemingly demented one who had learned his craft in slavery. You left with the founder in the black of the night, and I know it. You hurried silently along the river bottom, stung by mosquitoes, hooted by owls, zoomed by bats, buzzed by snakes that rattled among the rocks, mud and fever, darkness and sighing. You hid all the following day in the cabin where 13 slept in 3 small rooms, standing until darkness in the fireplace chimney, back in all the soot and ashes, guarded by the granny who dozed at the hearth, seemingly without a fire. You stood in the blackness, and when they came with their baying hounds, they thought her demented, but she knew. She knew. She knew the fire. She knew the fire. She knew the fire that burned without consuming. My God, yes! My God, yes! A woman's voice responded, adding to the structure of his vision within me, and you left him on the morning, hidden in a wagon load of cotton in the very center of the fleece where you breathe the hot air through the barrel of the emergency shotgun, the cartridges, which, thank God, it was unnecessary to use, held fanwise and ready between the spread fingers of your hand. And you went into this town with him and were hidden by the friendly aristocrat one night and on the next by the white blacksmith who held no hatred, surprising contradictions of the underground. Escaping. Yes. Helped by those who knew you and those who didn't know, because for some it was enough to see him. Others helped without even that, black and white, but mostly it was our own who aided, because you were their own, and we have always helped our own. And so, my young friends, my sisters and brothers, you went with him in and
out of cabins, by night and early morning, through swamps and hills, on and on, passed from black hand to black hand and some white hands, and all the hands molding the founder's freedom and our own freedom like voices shaping a deep felt song, and you, each of you, were with him. Ah, how well you know it, for it was you who escaped to freedom. Ah, yes, and you know the story.
I saw him resting now, and beaming out across the chapel, his huge head turning to all its corners like a beacon, his voice still echoing as I fought back my emotion. For the first time, the evocation of the founder saddened me, and the campus seemed to rush past me, fast retreating like the fading of a dream at the sundering of slumber. Beside me, the student's eyes swam with a distorting cataract of tears.